Text for Making Audiobook in MP3 of People from the Other World, by Henry S. Olcott. From the 1875 Ed edition. Part 1, The Eddy Manifestations. Chapter 1, The Eddy Family. 7 miles north from Rutland, in a grassy valley shut in by the slopes of the Green Mountains, lying high above the tidewater, is the little hamlet of Chittenden. There is nothing about it worthy of notice, and its sole claim to notoriety lies in the fact that it is the nearest post town to the homestead farm of the Eddy family of spiritual mediums, whose fame has spread over the whole country. The people of the vicinage are, apparently with few exceptions, plain, dull, and uninteresting, seeming to know nothing and to care less about the marvelous things that are happening under their very eyes, or even the history of their section. Inhabiting a rugged country which exacts much hard labor for small pecuniary returns, they go the round of their daily duty, and trouble themselves about nothing except to get the usual modicum of food and sleep. Their rare occasions of enjoyment are the days of the county fair, the elections, raisings, huskings, and like country assemblages. Their religion is intolerant, their sect Methodist, within the pale of which body all persons are good, without which all are bad. The liberalizing influences that in more thickly settled localities have, for the past 10 or 20 years, been leavening the whole religious world, seem to be unfelt in this secluded region. Towards the heterodox these people have no yearning bowels of compassion. Their weapons are both spiritual and carnal, and I judge from the sad story of the Eddy children that these zealots, if suddenly driven out of their beloved church, would feel more at home under the wing of Mahomet than elsewhere, for when prayer has failed of conversion they have resorted to fire and the lash to bring the lamb within the fold. I recently visited this place in the interest of the New York Sun, and spoke of the relations between the Eds and their neighbors in the following terms. There is nothing about the Eds or their surroundings to inspire confidence on first acquaintance. The brothers Horatio and William, who are the present mediums, are sensitive, distant, and curt to strangers, look more like hard-working rough farmers than prophets or priests of a new dispensation, have dark complexions, black hair and eyes, stiff joints, a clumsy carriage, shrink from advances, and make newcomers feel ill at case and unwelcome. They are at feud with some of their neighbors, and as a rule not liked either in Rutland or Chittenden. They are in fact under the ban of a public opinion that is not prepared or desirous to study the phenomena as either scientific marvels or revelations from another world. When I first began to write about these mediums, I became convinced that they had never done anything to deserve the reprobation of their neighbors, for a number of reports reflecting upon their character, upon being sifted, were discovered to be untrue. I could see prejudice so ill concealed by the narrators, and ignorance of the domestic life, to say nothing of the mediumistic faculty of the members of the family, so plainly revealed, that perhaps I went to unnecessary lengths in my defense of their reputations. In original book, had portraits of Eddy Brothers Carr, here. But since I began the work of revising my matter for this volume, I have met a former citizen of Chittenden, and a man of good character, now resident of a distant city, who is knowing to the fact that some 7 or 8 years ago two of the Eds gave an exhibition, or exhibitions, of certain of the commoner tricks of mediums, themselves included, and I was furnished with the names of witnesses who can corroborate the statement. It is not surprising, therefore, that a simple-minded people, prejudiced against everything that smacks of diabolism, and looking upon the Eddy ghost room as a chamber of horrors, should hastily adopt the opinion that if they were fools in the lesser phenomena they must be in all, and conclude that a family who could publicly confess their dishonesty, for pay, had good reason to adopt a forbidding aspect to strangers, especially those who would be likely to discover the trickery which furnishes them a support. I am not, I am happy to say, of that class of pseudo-investigators which rejects the chance of finding truth in these marvels because mediums occasionally cheat. It has often, and justly, been said that the circulation of counterfeit coin is no proof that the genuine does not exist, but the reverse, and the reports of most intelligent writers agree in the statement that nearly all public mediums occasionally simulate their phenomena when, from any cause, they cannot produce the real ones. Judge Edmonds and Mr. Robert Dale Owen both told me some years since that they had detected one of the best physical mediums in the United States, in trickery, thus corroborating my own experience with the same person, and a well-known artist in Hartford says that he discovered home, one of the greatest mediums ever known, in acts of deception, both before his departure for Europe, and during a subsequent visit to this country. As to this matter of the Eddie self-exposures, the parties interested tell me that their exposure was a mere pretense, resorted to for the purpose of raising money when they were in a very needy condition. In a word, they cheated the public with a sham exposure when it would not come to see them in their character of mediums. There can be but one opinion of such behavior as this, and, therefore, while my narrative will contain all that can be said on behalf of the remarkable mediumship, or apparent mediumship, of these boys, the reader will find that I shall not rely upon any of their manifestations that could be imitated by them, in working up my conclusions as to the reality of the phenomena. Such a course would be a waste of time and thought. I separate the medium from the man, considering him beyond a certain point an irresponsible being, that is, if there is any such thing as mediumship. In neglecting this, I think most investigators have hitherto erred. If it be true that persons of certain temperaments in this world may be controlled by persons in the other, then the mediums, being controlled, are not free agents, but machines. A person of this kind may, therefore, be a very bad man but a very good machine. Furthermore, if the medium's actions while serving as such are beyond his control, he may, unless he be entranced, observe them just as any spectator, and, observing, may learn to imitate, with more or less perfection according to his natural intelligence and endowments. Thus I observed the Eds at first in their double capacity, and determined at the outset not to allow anything they might say or do, or any of their surroundings, uncongenial with my own tastes or habits, to bias my verdict upon their claims as spiritual mediums. When I say that my first reception by the family was most inhospitable, that during my visit of 5 days I never felt sure that at any moment I might not be requested to leave, that I was made to feel like an intruder whose room was preferable to his company, that I was struggling against all the prejudice one naturally would feel against persons who claim to be able to summon an army of spirits from the other world, that I sat silent when members of the family made ungracious and threatening speeches against persons who might misrepresent them, clearly meaning me, that for fear my mission might be cut short and my ability to do my duty to my employers destroyed, I breathed not a word of my purpose to write for the newspaper, and left the place without having had a single opportunity to draw out their side of the story from the Eds. The public has reason to admit that in saying what I did in their favor I was at least actuated by no feelings of partiality. I was glad, when my second visit was so unexpectedly brought about, that things were just as they had been at the beginning, for I had heard all the evil stories in circulation and sifted them thoroughly, and was in a condition of mind to do justice to people who had not always acted so as to make friends, had few real ones, and few opportunities granted to lay their pathetic tale before the world. It was not because I had sympathy with their beliefs, nor that their welfare was a matter of greater personal concern than that of any other decent people, but because, in common with everyone else, my good wishes went with the weak and oppressed, and this family had been worried and torn by the spirit of intolerance, as a sheep by wolves. Manhood revolts at the persecutions, cruelties, and indignities they have been called to suffer in consequence of the direful inheritance of mediumship that was bequeathed them in their blood, an inheritance that made their childhood wretched, and, until recently, life itself a heavy burden. To explain my meaning, I will give some particulars of the family history as they have been communicated to me by the surviving children. Zephyr Eddy, a farmer living at Weston, VT, married one Julia Ann McCombs, a girl of Scotch descent who was born in the same town. She was first cousin to General Leslie Combs, of Kentucky, who changed his name to its present form, and was distantly related to a noble Scotch family. About the year 1846, Mr. Eddy sold his farm and removed to the present homestead in the town of Chittenden. Mrs. Eddy inherited from her mother the gift of foreseeing, as it is called among the Scotch, or more properly clairvoyance, for she not only had previsions of future events, but also the faculty of seeing the denizens of the mysterious world about us, from whom she claimed to receive visits as commonly as though they were ordinary neighbors. Not only this, but she could also hold speech with them, hear them address their conversation to the inner self within her, utter warnings of impending calamities, and sometimes bring tidings of joy. Her mother before her possessed the same faculties in degree, and her great-great-great-grandmother was actually tried and sentenced to death at Salem for alleged witchcraft in the dark days of 1692. But escaped to Scotland by the aid of friends who rescued her from jail. As F.I.R. Eddy was a narrow-minded man, strong in his prejudices, a bigoted religionist, and very little educated. His new wife instinctively withheld from him all knowledge of her peculiar psychological gifts, and for a time after their marriage she seemed to have lost them. But they returned after the birth of her first child stronger than ever, and from that time until the day of her death they were the source of much misery. Mr. Eddy at first made light of them, laughed at her prognostications, and forbade her giving way to what he declared was the work of the evil one himself. He resorted to prayer to abate the nuisance, or, as he styled it, to cast the devil out of his ungodly wife and children, and, that failing, to coercive measures, that proved equally inefficacious. The first child that was born had the father's temperament, but each succeeding one the mother's, and each, at a very tender age, developed her idiosyncrasies. Mysterious sounds were heard about their cradles, strange voices called through the rooms they were in. They would play by the hour with beautiful children, visible only to their eyes and the mother's, who brought them flowers and pet animals, and romped with them, and once in a while, after they were tucked away in bed, their little bodies would be lifted gently and floated through the air by some mysterious power. In vain the father stormed and threatened, the thing went on. He called his pious neighbors together: Harvey Pratt, Rufus Sprague, Sam Parker, Sam Simmons, Charles Powers, and Anson Ladd, and prayed that this curse might be removed from his house. But the devil was proof against entreaty and expostulation, and the harder they prayed the wickeder the pranks he played. Then the infuriated parent resorted to blows, and, to get the evil spirit out of them, he beat these little girls and boys until he made scars on their backs that they will carry to their graves. It seemed as if the man would go crazy with rage. By and by, things got so bad that the spirits would materialize themselves in the room, right in the father's view, and, not being able to handle them after his usual fashion, his only refuge was to leave the chamber. The children could not go to school, for before long, raps would be heard on the desks and benches, and they would be driven out by the teacher, followed by the hootings and revilings of the scholars. This, it will be remembered, was just what happened to the children of the unfortunates who were hung for witchcraft at Salem, the sins of the parents being cruelly visited upon the children. One night, when Horatio was 4 years old, a little creature covered with a white fur suddenly appeared in the room where he and three of the other children were sleeping, jumped upon their bed, sniffed at their faces, and then began growing larger and larger until it turned into a great luminous cloud, that gradually shaped itself into a human form. The children screamed, and the mother running in hastily with a candle, the shape disappeared. So year after year things went on, full of trouble and sorrow for all in the unhappy house. No wonder that I found them curt, repellent, and sensitive, and suspicious and calculated to arouse suspicion. I think I would be likewise under like circumstances. Poor Mrs. Eddy's misfortunes did not cease with her husband's death in 1860, but followed her even into her grave, as she one day in a prophetic vision told the children it would in the exact manner in which it happened. When her death occurred, January 1, 1873, it was intended that she should be buried by the spiritualists, certain of whom had promised to be present, but it so happened that they were detained away, and two Methodist friends of the husband's acted as sole pallbearers. As they were about to lower the coffin into the grave, these two worthies fell into dispute about a lawsuit that they had just had, and one, in his eagerness to get at his antagonist, dropped his rope and the poor lady was dumped end over end into the pit, and the coffin turned bottom side. One surprising instance of the cruelty begotten by ignorance is afforded in the means resorted to once to bring William Eddy out of a trance. Pushing, pinching, and blows proving in vain, Anson Ladd, with the father's permission, poured scalding hot water down his back, and, as a last heroic operation, put a blazing ember from the hearth on his head. But the lad slept on, and the only effect of this cruelty was the great scar that he has shown me on his crest. The father's scruples did not interfere with his willingness to turn a thrifty penny by an exhibition of the diabolical gifts of his progeny, for, after the Rochester knockings of 1847 had ushered in the new dispensation of spiritualism, he hired three or four of the children out to one showman, who took them to nearly all the principal cities of the United States, and to another who took them to London for a brief season. The children got all the kicks and he all the halfpence in this transaction, and a sorry time it was for them. Passed through the merciless hands of scores of committees of skeptics, bound with cords by sailors of 7 years' experience, and riggers accustomed to tick knots where human life was at risk, of carpenters with a fancy for other knots than those in their boards, of inventors who knew all sorts of ropes in addition to their particular steam engines or threshing machines, and such like illuminati. Their soft young metacarpal bones were squeezed out of shape, and their arms covered with dial scars of melted wax, used to make the assurance of the bonds doubly and trebly sure. These wrists and arms are a sight to see. Every girl and boy of them has a marked groove between the ends of the ulna and radius and the articulation of the bones of the hand, and every one of them is scarred by hot sealing wax. Two of the girls showed me scars where pieces of flesh had been pinched out by handcuffs used by committees fools who seem to have been unable to discover suspected fraud without resort to brutal violence on the persons of children. And then the mobbings they have passed through. At Lynn, Mass., South Danvers, West Cleveland, Ohio, where William was ridden on a rail and barely escaped a coat of tar and feathers, at Moravia, N.Y., at Waltham, Mass., where they had to fly for their lives, at Dunville, Canada, in all which places their cabinet, a simple, portable closet, in which they sit for the manifestations, was smashed. They make no account in this catalogue of suffering, of the places where they were stoned, hooted at, and followed to their hotels by angry crowds. At South Danvers they were fired upon by hidden assassins, and William has the scar of a bullet in his ankle and Mary one in her arm to show for their picnic in that tolerant locality. Horatio carries his memento of that place in a stab wound in his leg, and Lynn supplied him with the two tokens of a scar on his forehead, where a brick hit him, and a broken finger, the third, on his right hand. Ah! These committees are often honorable gentlemen, as may be inferred from the fact that once when applying the flower test, the placing of flower in the medium's hands after his wrists are tied, to detect him if he disengages his hands and plays upon the instruments himself, aquafortis was mixed in the flower, and shockingly burned Horatio's fingers, and once, when the musical instruments, horns, and sea, were rubbed with rouge, so that the mediums might be betrayed by their discolored hands if they should touch them, one of the committee, pretending to make a last examination of the knots, rubbed the hands of both the boys with rouge. In this instance, however, the base trick availed nothing, for, aware of what had been done, the Eds called for the audience to look at their hands before the cabinet doors were closed, and the culprit was exposed. The reader will understand, from what I have said of their childhood experiences, that these poor creatures had little or no educational advantages, and their numerous correspondents will not be surprised at the illiteracy shown in their letters. They will be surprised, on the other hand, when I say that I have heard words in six foreign tongues spoken, and conversations sustained in the same, by rappings by some of the phantoms whose appearance before me, during my present visit to the Eddy homestead, I shall describe in future chapters of this true story. The Daily Graphic was pleased to say in a letter of mine from this place, that the story is as marvelous as any to be found in history, an opinion that was reiterated by several of the most respected journals in other cities. I risk nothing in now saying that what I am about to narrate is far more extraordinary in every respect, and I expect to tax the public indulgence as to my veracity to the utmost. But I shall at least take good care to be within the limits of the truth, so that my story may be verified by any future investigator who is willing to scan closely, move cautiously to conclusions, and nothing extenuate nor aught set down in malice. This was page 29. I went to Chittenden to discover the truth as to the Eddy manifestations, and as I find things, so shall I describe them, caring nothing how much my own prejudices are affected by the result. The sketches that illustrate this chapter represent the Eddy homestead as viewed from the southeast, rear, and north side. The house is the first frame building erected in Chittenden Township, and for many years was a wayside inn. It comprises a main building and a rear extension, or L, of two stories, of which the lower is divided into a dining room, kitchen, and small cupboard or pantry, and the upper, thrown into one room, is known as the circle room, or among the profane, as the ghost shop. In the rear view, the kitchen door is seen at the hither end of the L part, and the square window in the gable end gives light into the cabinet or narrow closet in which William Eddy sits when the materializations occur. Chapter 2, Treatment of Public Mediums. The story of the persecutions, mobbings, hardships and trials through which the Eddy children were obliged to pass, carries a moral with it, which the intelligent reader can hardly have overlooked. It must have been apparent that we are not dealing with the case of charlatans who have recently taken to the business of trickery for the sake of gain, for these girls and boys seem to have inherited their peculiar temperaments from their ancestry, and the phenomena common to most genuine 11 mediums of the present day, attended them in their very cradles. It will scarcely be said that children who, like Elisha, were caught up and conveyed from one place to another, and in whose presence weird forms were materialized as they lay in their trundle bed, were playing pranks to tax the credulity of an observant public, which was ignorant of their very existence. It will not be seriously urged, I fancy, against youth, whose bodies were scored with the lash cicatrized by burning wax, by pinching manacles, by the knife, the bullet and by boiling water, who were starved, driven to the woods to save their lives from parental violence, who were forced to travel year after year and exhibit their occult powers for others' gain, who were mobbed and stoned, shotted and reviled, who could not get even an ordinary country school education like other children, nor enjoy the companionship of boys and girls of their own age. It will not be urged against such as these that they were in conspiracy to deceive, when they had everything to gain and nothing to lose by abandoning the fraud and being like other folk. The idea is preposterous, and we must infer that, whatever may be the source of the phenomena, they are at least objective and not subjective, the result of some external force, independent of the medium's wishes, and manifesting itself when the penalty of its manifestation was to subject the unfortunates to bodily torture and mental anguish. We must turn back to Fox's Book of Martyrs if we would catch the diabolical spirit that has been exhibited towards these men during the 15 years that they travel the country to exhibit their wonderful gifts, for, while our times are not those of the 8th Harry's cruel daughter, the feeling of intolerance in the church towards these latter-day heretics is substantially the same as that which sent Ridley and Latimer Bradford and Cranmer to the stake, and caused Galvin to procure death of his learned fellow Protestant, Servetus. This is the first time within my knowledge that this side of the medium question has been discussed, and in the hope that the example may be imitated, I will show some of the barbarities inflicted upon these Eddy boys by committees. 34. To understand the matter, persons who have never attended a public spiritist exhibition should be told what the performance is like. In a public hall, upon the platform, is set up a wardrobe, or cabinet, made of half-inch walnut, 7 feet high, 6 feet wide, 2 feet deep, and resting on trestles 18 inches high, to permit a full view into the cabinet and satisfy the spectator that there is no communication through traps with its interior. The front is composed of three doors, the side ones swinging to right and left respectively, and the center one to right. At each end inside is a narrow board seat, supported on cleats, and one of like width runs the width of the cabinet against the back wall. In the upper half of the center door is a diamond-shaped opening, behind which hangs a black velvet curtain. The mediums enter, and, seating themselves on the end seats, are firmly bound hand and foot by a committee selected by the audience, the cords being passed through auger holes in the bench. Various musical instruments are placed within, beyond reach of the bound mediums, and, the doors being closed, a variety of curious phenomena occur. The instruments are vigorously played upon, loud percussive noises are heard, bands are thrust out of the opening, and other exhibitions occur that a strange force is at work. The cabinet doors, self-unbolted, suddenly open, and the two mediums are discovered sitting as before, with not a single knot disturbed. The committees selected by vote of the audience usually embrace men who are supposed to be unusually acute, such as detectives, skillful noteers, such as sailors and riggers, and those whose education and intelligence are likely to make them competent to fathom the philosophical mystery. In looking over the scrapbooks of the Eds, I find the newspapers, as a rule, reporting such choice of committeemen, and I also find there the evidences of the unnecessary cruelties practiced in the interest of science, religion, fair play, and particularly of what these gentry are pleased to call the truth. The reader will please observe that I have not relied upon the diaries or verbal statements of the Eds themselves in making these strictures, but solely upon the testimony of the editorial descriptions of the whole press, for the journals of nearly every section are represented in this modern book of martyrs. Such details of the handcuffings and ligatures, the blisterings and acid corrosions, the torture of constrained positions, of mouth gags and halter nooses, as the newspapers did not supply, I have filled in after getting the necessary explanations from the mediums, and the drawings were made from life. I cannot refrain from making a single quotation from Horatio's diary, under date of November, 1867, for it shows the patient, uncomplaining spirit that possessed the poor farmer boy under his sufferings. It seems the most appropriate introduction I could make to these sketches. He says, "This day we suffered very much by severe tying and abuse from those who professed to be spiritualists, but we like martyrs, bore our pain with fortitude. We thanked the divine power for preserving us from the gross treatment of our enemies. No mortal knows what brutish tying we submitted ourselves to. It would have made mother's heart bleed if she had known what her children were passing through in Canastota. How they were treated by the Canastota Committee sketch number 4 will show. Horatio was kept with one hand tied to his neck and the other to his manacled feet for 3/4 of an hour, the cord around his neck being so tight as to half choke him. The little falls, n.y., investigators tried the pretty device shown in sketch number 1. The medium is tied to a wooden T-cross, by whipcord passing through holes bored for the purpose. He was kept so for the space of an hour, until, owing to the tightness of the ligatures at the wrists, the blood trickled from under his fingernails. Sketch number 3 will recall a scene of rope tying, to the minds of the good people of Albany, N.Y., who attended a séance at the house of John McClure, a certain Dr. Perkins being the operator. Here the medium is tied down by his fingers to the floor, the tapes being secured to the latter by tacks, and another tape leading to the doorknob. The worthy doctor kept this patient in this position some 2 hours, and it is not surprising that his wrists were so swollen in consequence that he was kept in pain several days thereafter. Sketch number 2 shows a common device of the Wiley Committee men of Moriah, N.Y., and numerous other eye places, and the drawing requires no word of comment. Moriah, N.Y. Perhaps I do not get the name just right, but the Eds cannot help me, is also responsible for the cheerful bucking antidote against charlatanry, seen in sketch number 6, in which attitude the victim was obliged to state to mortal hours, the spirits refusing to manifest themselves under such disturbed conditions, and the committee, with astonishing cruelty, declaring they would keep him there until they did. This happened at the house of Isaac Colvin,